The Killing Type, a novel by Wayne Jones, Chapter 15. I pull myself together the following night. I consider the obvious and start wondering whether Tony could possibly be a murderer with a penchant for self-assured emails flaunting her eventual illusion of capture. Like any other revolutionary speculation and research, the idea seems both crazy and self-evident at the same time. I do not completely share the mob's disillusionment with the police, but now I do sense a little resentment building in me at the prospect that I, a mere ex-researcher, a writer of books, a harmless drudge, should be the one who's trying to tease out tidbits and be the only person who is effectively investigating this case. No, I did not find Tony by using techniques of inspired Holmesian or even Milhonian deduction, but I am a firm believer in the power and the meaning of serendipity. I did not just happen to be at the library reading books on the same topic as she was. I was, as some bronzed bimbo said on TV this evening, in the zone, and primed like a medium for the interception of clues and hints and people who are likely to be involved in this serial mess. I learned from carrying out literary research that things are not always as they appear. In fact, a certain wariness serves well as a guiding first principle so as to prevent one from making assumptions where they should not be made. My own dismissal from TU, for example, was an egregious example of specious reasoning being used to arrive at what would be an untenable decision in more rational circumstances, involving people who were less animated by open-mindedness than by a tendency toward hasty conclusion. But I have talked enough about that here. In the case of Tony, the simplistic analysis yields a seemingly obvious conclusion on either side. She revels in talk of murder and so seems a likely candidate for some experimentation with same. And she's a gregarious girl with a quirky sense of humor whom it is hard to imagine cutting up one victim or throwing another one off a building. However, the case studies are filled with examples of serial killers bragging about their conquests and those like Ted Bundy who were the epitome of charm. Objectivity is a bitch of a god in any kind of analysis or research. You strive to please her, you do everything you can to ensure that her strictures and requirements are met, and you still end up with a shabby approximation of the knowledge you were trying to discover. You call them facts, but deep down you know they are not, and you are slightly ashamed of your duplicity and complicity in this doomed effort. My general process for writing this damn book has also been a horrendous experience in other regards. First, the mechanics of my composition. From conversations and correspondences which I have had with writers along the whole range of expertise, everyone from well-published academics and professional journalists to amateurs who slog away at occasional freelance pieces which disgrace one print publication or another, even to people whose oeuvre consists of nothing but letters to mom and short stories tucked away, thankfully, in a drawer while they tend to children and the other practicalities of the non-artistic life. By far the most of those writers tell me that they write by first gushing out sentences and then relying on the editing stage to hone the words into something beautiful or informative. My own method is quite different. I do not commit a sentence to paper or to the screen until I am satisfied with its overall heft, with both the what and the how, the content and the style. In the case of my book on the serial killings, this method has proven to be a considerable mental strain. Instead of cathartically relieving myself of the burden of a particularly brutal fact, for example, I have to stew over all of its atrocious detail in my attempt to render the information accurately and articulately. I read somewhere once that Anthony Burgess was surprised at how difficult he'd found the writing of his novel, A Clockwork Orange. He had thought and hoped that a writer would be able to write about anything, that extreme violence should be as easy to master. I'm forgetting his exact comparison now, and so admit to speculation, as, let's say, the most banal of domestic dramas. My own background research has also been trying. I have felt that it is necessary to provide the reader with context. Therefore, I have sought out and read intently a wide range of murder books, case studies in which the most horrific crimes are dispassionately presented in all their inhuman detail, junk true crime paperbacks cranked out by self-important hacks interested more in money and titillation than in anything else, articles in academic journals, police reports, newspaper features on killers from Humbert to Homolka. I turn on my computer, and while it boots itself up, I get out of my clothes as if I am shedding something dead, a skin. While I am throwing them into the bottom of the closet with the rest of the soiled laundry from a tough week, I hear the computer make its musical sound as if it is delighted to be revived again. I put on loose shorts and a long t-shirt and sit down at the flat screen. I have another email. Oh, dear Jesus, but you are a sight for a killing type such as myself. I feel somewhat like the ghost of Hamlet's father, coming back not to inspire you to action, but to remind you of your haplessness and futility. Give up. Lay the book aside. Stop this incessant analysis, or semblance of same, and return to whatever hole you came out of, and leave me be to finish my job. I've killed and I will kill again, and your meddling will be something I merely crush as I proceed undeterred. There is no deliberation this time. I call the police. An officer Karp tells me to forward the email to him, but also to save it on my own computer. I'd also like to ask you a few questions, if you don't mind. Of course. His throat is cleared. Some papers are shuffled. Do you know of anyone who would be sending you this kind of message? Perhaps not even seriously, just as a joke, perhaps. No, of course not. Why do you say, of course not? Well, just that it's not much of a joke, is it? I mean, it's not funny. Actually, a little scary for me, anyway. Yes, I can understand that. Okay, another question. Have you ever had an email like this before? Is this the first one? No, this is the first one, I lie, boldly and baldly, seeing no point in divulging my negligence, my suppression of evidence, I suppose. I do a quick calculation in my head, and the result is that it's unlikely that this lie will ever come back to hurt me. Either the killer will be caught, making the point moot, or he will not be, and the police will be busy with more important things than a couple of prequel emails. Okay, he says, sounding more or less convinced. Listen, I'm going to have to let you go now, but we'll be reading through this email and we'll likely be calling you again, perhaps even to come down to answer a few more questions, all part of the routine. A few more questions or maybe an officer could come to your house. I'm not sure whether he is asking or telling. Sure, I say, and he hangs up abruptly. I click off my own phone, but it rings immediately again. Yes, I say, expecting a forgotten follow-up question from Karp. But there is only silence. I utter an embarrassing series of who's there and hello, like a frantic woman in some cheap horror movie, but there is no satisfaction provided by the other end. I hear literally nothing, not even breathing. After about a minute, the connection goes dead, and I click off my own phone and set it back down on an end table. Later that evening, as we had arranged via much more prosaic emails, I meet Rachel, the librarian, at her apartment. In a demonstration of trust and helpfulness that literally brings a tear to my eye, a man she hardly knows being invited into her home, she has agreed to review some of my research and to suggest avenues for future investigation. I turn off the sidewalk, go up to the purple door, and knock. Feet make a sound on what sounds like hardwood, and the radio, playing a classical movement that I can't quite place, Sibelius perhaps, is promptly turned down. She lives on the first floor of a small brick house on Pembroke Street, less than a 10-minute walk from my own place. "Hi, Andrew," she says, even before the door is fully open. "It's so good to see you." and the door is closed quietly but efficiently behind me. She leads me into a living room of elegant though somewhat cramped comfort and invites me to sit down on what is either a small couch or a larger love seat. I choose the left side, inattentively worried that she might have to squeeze in beside me, but once I am settled, I see that there is an armchair at about a 45-degree angle to the right arm. "I was just about to get myself some tea," she says. "Would you like some, or could I get you coffee or something else?" "No alcohol in the place," she laughs. "Tea sounds great." While she's in the kitchen, I remove some of my handwritten notes and a pen from my portfolio. A shiver of hopelessness goes through me as I wonder what I am doing here and what I could glean from anyone about this impossible case. But I right myself at about exactly the time that Rachel comes with our tea. "It's Earl Grey," she says. "I hope that's okay." "Wonderful. For me, tea is like a fine wine that I only have occasionally. I have to admit that I drink a kind of swill of coffee most days and treat myself to latte now and then, but tea is a real, well, treat." She performs the delicate movements required to position the cups on our respective end tables, and while she is touching the top of the lid and pouring mine, I take the opportunity to observe her in all her integrity. The concentration might be the same as she devotes to a game of chess with a colleague or to a particularly tricky question from a patron at the library. I'm embarrassed when pourer's eyes meet starer's, but she simply smiles, sets the teapot down on a doily, and settles into her chair as if she is waiting for me to ask the first interview question. "It feels odd," she says finally, and I sigh internally. "It feels odd to have the luxury of sitting here a while. You know, while there's someone out there killing people, and while there are family and friends out there whose lives have been ruined by all this, I feel guilty sometimes." Her cup clacks onto the saucer more loudly than she evidently meant it to, and she seems to be somewhat startled. There's a ripple in her composure, but she recovers quickly. "That's a common reaction," I say, relieved to know something. In the research I've done, it's clear that there is a whole variety of emotions and reactions that serial murder causes, some quite surprising. In one town, I don't remember where just now, but the citizens started vandalizing the city. It wasn't that they were angry at the police or anything like that, just the tendency toward crime spreading like some sort of virus. Or at least that was one of the theories. "Wow, that's fascinating. I guess I have more pedestrian theories myself, or speculations, or whatever you want to call them. One thing is that I'm not sure why people just don't hole up in their apartments, in their houses, and just never come out until the man is caught. I'm kind of amazed at myself that I don't do that, actually. I'll be walking down the street after an evening shift at work, like when it's just starting to get dark, and it only suddenly occurs to me then that, well, you know, and I kind of rush home then. I set my cup down with the intention of reassuring the poor woman. "Listen," I say a little too imperatively, "I firmly believe that in spite of the obvious, we're all fairly safe in town. Not to sound too crude and mathematical about it, but it's highly unlikely that little you or little anyone is going to be, so to speak, selected." She laughs awkwardly at this and sets down her own cup. I notice for the first time, with the light a certain way and my own plans and inspirations at a certain angle, how beautiful she is. It is my turn to be embarrassed now at two contradictory speculations that are now swirling in my tea-soaked brain. The first is a desire for love, with scenarios quickly formed of the seekers of information, the humble neglected scholar and the integrative librarian traveling the world from writer's birthplace to writer's death place, Sam in Litchfield, Vladimir near Montreux. Alas, I also have a horrible waking nightmare of another speculation, with Rachel as murderer inviting the hapless investigator to her house in order to get her name crossed off any mental list of suspects. No need to kill me when she can just distract me with feigned friendliness. Of course, even the bare thought is utterly ridiculous, and I'm saddened, but not demonstrably so, I don't think, that this is the kind of meanness that my mind has been reduced to. Everyone is a suspect, and the least likely, the more suspicious. In fact, I'll say it here now, I've heard titterings around town pointing to my own guilt, the factitious, quote-unquote, reasoning being that the murders started soon after I arrived in town, and why would a prestigious academic such as myself choose to leave the big city anyway? Not that these charges are within a small town, country mile of any credibility, and are actually something of an insult to perhaps the one person who has been carrying on anything approaching an investigation, but the... Andrew, are you okay? It's Rachel, whom I have been impolitely ignoring while I wallow in a travesty of post hoc logic. I'm so sorry, I say quite sincerely. My mind was just wandering there for a while, distracted a bit. You know, it's wonderful of you to have me over, and perhaps we can talk about... I leave it vague in order to let her have any entrance she is comfortable with. She sighs and starts. It's so good of you even to take the time to talk to me. And yes, at first I'd wanted to pump you for information about your theories, how your research is going, all of that, and also tell you a bit of what I think myself. But I kind of find the whole topic distressing and depressing from that angle. No offense, of course. I think it's wonderful what you are doing. I guess now, though, all I want is someone to talk to about, well, about what's going to happen to me and to the town after this whole thing is over. And I hope to God that it is over soon. I'm not sure what you mean. Her mouth screws downward in a peculiar way, and for a moment I think she is about to cry. I am reminded in passing of how utterly impossible it is to know what is going on in the true heart of a person, no matter what the dedication to forthright communication. She rights herself, though, and continues. I guess my main point, my worry, is how do people recover from this? Do you know what I mean? The guy will be caught and jailed and there won't be any threat anymore, but when will we all feel safe again? I'm not making any sense, I know, but I've had these wild desires myself just to move out of town, get a job somewhere else, either now or when the whole damn thing is over. There's a hint of a smile on her face now, or at least something approaching confidence or defiance, and that warms me. Listen, Rachel, from the research I've done, all of what you are saying are common reactions. The best I can tell you is that ultimately, whole towns do recover from this kind of thing. People get on with their lives, and not all of them have to quit their jobs to do so. She laughs out loud at this, and I genuinely feel that something has changed in the room and between us. She gets up and replenishes my cup of tea, smiling at me as she sets the pot back down. I sit and look up at her as she remains standing. I lied, she says, and my eyebrows have literally gone up and down before she continues. I do have alcohol here. Let's have a drink. She's not really asking, and so I just sit there silently while her eyebrows go up. She smiles, and then she corrals both cups and saucers and the teapot back onto the tray and ferries it all quickly out to the kitchen. I hear what sounds like a clattery avalanche into the sink, and then the distinct clack of dish on the floor, followed by shit, and ending with a shouted instruction to me that I cannot discern. I go into the kitchen and find her kneeling, picking up the pieces. A little accident, she says, but still smiling. May I help? Can you grab me a dishcloth, a clean one, there in the second drawer from the top, by the fridge? There is a very orderly stack of them, mostly whites and blues and greens, and I shuffle down to the third one, which I hand to her. It's just one of the cups which is broken, but it has splashed tea in a wide radius. While Rachel wipes, I go to my knees myself and pick up some of the pieces which she has missed. My former irrational worry sweeps over me briefly, and I conclude that if she really wanted to kill me, this wouldn't be a bad method. Break a dish, lure me into the kitchen, and then have at me with the paring knife she has concealed up her sleeve. We both stand at the same time. She takes the shards from me, wraps them in the dishcloth, and places the bundle in the sink. "Now where was I?" she asks rhetorically. "It feels like a gin and tonic night to me. Is that okay?" "Perfect. I loathe the medicine-y stuff, but it feels better to comply." I cut slices of lime while she measures exact ounces into a shot glass. We each pour tonic to our taste, and Rachel then plops a couple of ice cubes into each glass and stirs them with a teaspoon. We resume our positions in the living room, and I am happy that the conversation diverts to something other than killing and feeling and feeling after killing. Rachel has traveled extensively all around the world, Newfoundland last year and Nepal in the fall. She's a Scrabble fiend, apparently, having just last night cleared her tiles with babyish. She's never been married, is wary of dating, would like to have children someday, but is generally very happy. "I'm afraid I'm just a humble scholar," I tell her, adding ex-scholar when she brightens just a tad too much, and I suddenly want to dampen enthusiasm. Maybe it's the drink affecting me. "What's your, well, story?" she asks. "You know, what have you done? Where are your friends and family?" You may regret asking those questions because I can go on. I only half joke, and she shakes her head vigorously but silently, allowing me to go on and on. A short, snorty laugh, and then, "Please do." "Seriously, there's not much to tell. I've always been a bit introverted, deriving my energy from solitude and often preferring the company of dependable books to the messiness of personal relationships. I hope you know what I mean. It's not that I don't like people or that I don't enjoy their company as I am yours right now, but it often makes me a bit nervous and uncomfortable." "I understand what you mean. I'm a librarian, you know. We're not exactly known for being the life of the party." The gin is tasting just fine in spite of myself, and I sense a basic insight coming from me which reminds me of some of the eureka moments during my research. It is embarrassingly very little time. Simply a realization that this is how friendship begins. An invitation to do X, a switch to Y, a tiny moment of intimacy and mutual comfort over a broken dish, and then it seems unusual that we won't be seeing each other at least a couple of times a week. The reader should note that no romantic inclinations are desired on either part. I am sure of my own, and I have near certain confidence of Rachel's merely, how they always say merely, as if friendship is any less because it does not involve sex, platonic attentions as well. The evening proceeds like that, frank exchanges of information and interest from both of us. We do have a few more drinks and end with some accident-free tea again and some chocolate. When I am standing at her front door on my way out, she puts a hand on my shoulder and kisses me lightly on the top of my cheek. Her hair smells like peaches, and I walk back home fully intending to see her again.